Not the military industrial media, this is Active Ingredients. On April 9th, 2006, Abby Adams of the Information Collective, or infocollective.org, presented John Judge on the U.S. government's role in the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
John Judge is a longtime activist and independent researcher, author, and lecturer whose areas of expertise span 9/11, Jonestown, covert operations, and the intelligence community, amongst others. He was co-founder of the Committee for an Open Archives, formed in 1989 to obtain government documents related to the murders of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. This organization formed into the Coalition on Political Assassinations, where he served as executive director. He is here tonight to speak about his work as the Special Project Coordinator for Representative Cynthia McKinney and the legislative push to declassify the government documents on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King.
I recall where I was when Dr. King was killed. I was in college in the University of Dayton in Ohio. I used to go back into the classroom buildings at night to study and read because it was quiet and well lit. And I was in one of the rooms and heard out in the hallway, a cleaning woman had a cart with a little radio on it, and it was announcing that Dr. King had been shot in Memphis. By that point, I was already steeped in working on the John F. Kennedy assassination. I was reading the Warren Commission volumes at the library at school, and I remember going out in the hallway and the woman standing there, you know, stuck on the cart and crying. We were already vigiling on the campus against the war in Vietnam. I called the people to the vigil, and we had a vigil the next day. I made a sign that said, "The King of Love is dead." And I understood the importance of Dr. King's movement and his nonviolence and his shift, which he got a lot of heat for, from merely dealing with the civil rights movement and putting it in the broader context. Dr. King said that there were three pillars of oppression in the society, and they all had to be addressed. Racism was one, poverty was another, and militarism was a third. And a year to the day before he died, as Doug mentioned, in Riverside Church, King gave a speech coming out against the Vietnam War, a reaction in part to the work of Dr. William Pepper, who in those days was an independent journalist in Vietnam, who had taken pictures that were printed in Ramparts magazine in an issue called The Children of Vietnam that showed the damage done by napalm to the children in Vietnam in the war. And when Dr. King saw the photos, he pushed his food aside and said that he could no longer remain silent about the war. But speaking against the war and moving in that direction put him in a direct path with the elements in intelligence and in the Pentagon and the other intelligence agencies that did not want the rise of a black messiah, as the COINTELPRO documents from the FBI said. They did not want leadership going in that direction. In addition to that, Dr. King, in the last year of his life, began to move toward organizing a poor people's march to Washington, D.C., that was not going to march solely, but was going to sit in the shadow of the Capitol until things changed in this country. And they understood what draw he had, what power he had to lead that, the moral authority that he had garnered from his movement. They saw him as a dangerous leader. When Martin Luther King came close to Malcolm X and began to work with Malcolm on the poverty issues and to agree to that, that I would argue is some, not all, but some of the momentum for the death of Malcolm X as well, who was assassinated as part of these plots. The spying on Dr. King, and I don't know if Doug knows this, actually dates back to an earlier period than just when he made these radical moves. And the early spying on civilians in this country for political purpose really begins in earnest at the end of World War I, some during World War I, but primarily at the end of World War I, when an individual by the last name of Vandeman in Army intelligence begins to collect files on radicals, on communists, on political activists, but they were also looking at race politics. And files were opened that long ago, in the period right after World War I, on Dr. King's grandfather. And so they were surveilling the King family all through those years. as well as other people who even as ministers or people in the community were providing some sort of leadership or a potential to organize people. And it was Vandeman's files that led to the Palmer raids in the 1920s and the attacks on communists and mass deportations and also attacks in the courts and phony charges against much of the immigrant community that came into the United States at that point and that shared the radical politics of the era because the industrialists and the monarchists were very frightened by the Russian Revolution. They did not want it to spread. Herbert Hoover, who spent more time in Europe than the United States, became president of the United States later, set up a fund, first to fund the White Russian response to the Bolsheviks and to try to undermine the revolution, and then created an international fund with the monarchists and the big industrialists across the world to fund a secret rearmament of Germany from 1918 to 1932, which led to the drive back to Moscow under Hitler and the final attempt for a direct attack on the Soviet Union. And these elements were operating sort of with that philosophy and bringing it into a domestic context. So it is Vandeman that then provides the files to a young government employee, John Edgar Hoover, who was actually working with the Bonaparte family in the United States, a nephew of the Bonapartes in early government spying operations, and then forces the Congress to create a federal police that he headed up. The trend in the direction that leads to Martin Luther King's death fortifies itself then at the end of World War II. Two people come over at the end of, well, actually during World War II, two people come over to the FBI in 1942 from the Office of Naval Intelligence, which is the oldest and largest intelligence unit in the United States. And almost unknown, DIA, most people don't know those initials, Defense Intelligence Agency, has 80% of the intelligence budget and has many more employees than the FBI and the CIA combined. You can find 100 books, 200 books on the CIA. I challenge you to find 10 books on the DIA, the ONI, the NSA, the NRO, and the elements that really run the intelligence in this country. The CIA is a think tank, but when it wants something done, it has to go to military intelligence to get it done because they have the equipment and the guns. They have the expertise. And so these elements were growing, but the ONI came over understanding that eventually what would emerge from World War II was a broader intelligence system. World War II, in its final stages, I would argue, what became entirely an intelligence war that was won not by military force but by intelligence manipulation. And that put the intelligence agencies, not only the United States, but in other countries, in the cat's seat in terms of making decisions after the war. In addition to that, there was complete cross-penetration between Nazi intelligence, British intelligence, U.S. intelligence. We didn't have the capability to do the kind of intelligence around the world that the Brits did. They had run empire for thousands or hundreds of years, you know, and they understood how colonialization worked, and so we used them to train us. The charter of the American CIA was written by Sir William Stevenson and Ian Fleming, who later wrote the James Bond books at the end of the war. They brought British intelligence here and combined them with the FBI. The FBI had international functions at that point. But in 1942, two people come over from the Office of Naval Intelligence. It's also important in terms of when you're hearing Doug say that the mafia paid for the assassination of Dr. King, you should understand that the mafia is nothing more than errand boys in terms of how this system operates. And the connections between organized crime and organized intelligence begin in World War II with the protection, supposedly, of the mob against German saboteurs in the docks of New York. And it's a connection that eventually releases Lucky Luciano from prison. From prison, he sends his scarf to General Patton, who shows his double L scarf to Don Caligaro Vizzini up in the hills above Palermo, and they travel through Sicily at a fast rate. They called it Lucky Forward. Well, it's Lucky Luciano Forward because they're making a deal with the mafia, who are chased into the hills by Mussolini, to come back down out of those hills. But it allows them to establish a base in Sicily and then come down into the cities and take over Italy in the middle of World War II. And those connections maintain into the post-war period their CIA and OSS connections with organized crime to make sure that the post-world, post-World War II globe doesn't go communist. They have mafia goons beating up strikers in Marseille at the end of the war, for instance, or moving in places where they're in danger of communists being elected into power after World War II, because some of the history of the resistance to World War II centers itself among communists and people of a left persuasion, and they didn't want those people to rise out of that struggle in the end, having defeated the Nazis and the fascists, to rise then into state power. So the Office of Naval Intelligence provides two people to Hoover to tell him basically that when this new post-World War intelligence arises, when the OSS then eventually becomes the CIA, they will protect his turf. They will make sure that he's in charge of domestic spying, CIA only spies abroad, and he's not going to be completely threatened by these new developments. Their names are Cartha Deak DeLoach and William Sullivan from ONI. And these are two names, if you know anything about COINTELPRO, they form the Domestic Operation Division of the Central or the FBI, and they run the counterintelligence program against the left, against the civil rights movement, against black leadership in this country, against the peace movements and the anti-war movements, against all different kinds of expressions of democratic sentiment or sentiments against oppression, begin to be not only surveilled but infiltrated, bad-jacketed, as they call it, rumors, pitted against each other so that you can use one section to kill the other. As Jay Gould said, the great baron industrialist in the, you know, the robber baron era, he said, I can hire one half of the ruling class to kill the other half. And so you pit people against each other. You have provocateur agents that go in and create criminal situations that the police can then respond to. You look into non-criminal groups for what they're doing. Eventually, these things were challenged in the 70s by the Frank Church Committee in the Senate. And there were hearings and there were rules passed to stop the abuses. But post 9/11, all those have been blown away. In fact, in the news commentary in the days after 9/11, the first thing blamed for 9/11 was the Frank Church Committee, that we had tied the hands of the FBI and the CIA by not letting them spy on civilians and all of that, and so they needed to have their powers back. And it was interesting to me that when the pundits were arguing this, at one point they went over and a spokesperson from the CIA said, well, these people are misled, we don't need those legal authorities. And they don't, because they operate without them. In fact, a hitman doesn't want a legal authority to assassinate people, because then he doesn't have a level of deniability. If you're killing people after they make it legal to kill people, then they're going to know who's doing it. And so it's better to maintain a sort of covert illegality about things where they're not openly assented to. So you have President Ford, executive order saying that they can't go abroad and assassinate people unless it's for a reason of national security. That little tagline is still inside the executive order. And, of course, there's always some reason that things have to do with national security. And it's a very broad and vaguely defined term. But you have a situation where they're not only surveilling people, but they're actually trying to disrupt and destroy these movements. They're trying to pit people against each other and make it impossible for them to organize. And so that goes on with black bag jobs and where they go in and take things out of the apartment without you knowing about it, or phone surveillance. The NSA develops Operation Harvest by the 1980s, where they can simultaneously tap 450,000 telephones at the same time in any given area. And then they have computers listen to the tapes of the phones for key words. And then they harvest out the lines that they want to listen to more often, and then they start listening to those and see if they get more multiplication of keywords until they get down to the few phones that they want to tap all the time and that they want human ears to listen to. That's Operation Harvest, to get to the top of the pyramid. So they say, well, do you think you're tapping your phone? Everybody gets to get their phone tapped at some point, at least for a while. You know, people, I don't worry about it, because my attitude is the people listening to me with those human ears are on the lowest level of the need-to-know chain. Maybe they'll learn something. The boss ain't going to tell them why they're there. And so it's a matter of going against that or cracking that, but that framework was in place, and its warnings against the ability of black leadership to rise at the time of the civil rights movement and through the anti-war period and on into the 70s, and many organizations were disrupted and destroyed. much of the capability of the left and progressive movements was disrupted in the 1960s. It's, I think, sort of cachet now to say, oh, well, they tried all those things and they don't work. But we didn't just try them and they didn't work. They made sure they didn't work. Okay, and they did things to destroy what could have been a broader movement and a movement that was for real change and was seen by them as an insurgency, as a literal insurgency. May 1970, when people came to D.C. to shut the town down in the demonstration, they were eventually locked up in the stadiums in an illegal mass arrest. But they had troops in the tunnels beneath the White House ready to come up armed and protect the White House if need be. But when the officer told the troops to lock and load, they refused as a whole unit. And that was happening in Vietnam. On the ground, too, units began to refuse to fire at Vietnamese that they saw out in the field. They just let them pass. They started refusing in units and sitting down. They stood up to the officers. They disobeyed the orders. And by the end of the war, they began killing the officers so that the lifespan of a new second lieutenant was shorter than a paratroop medic. And they began to, as they call, fragging them with fragmentation grenades. But they had a revolt on their hands in the field there, and they had a similar problem here. The first demonstration that I knew about in the war, the anti-war movement against Vietnam, came out of Harlem. Malcolm X had a hand in organizing it. And the organizing slogan, if you'll pardon my French, is, no Vietnamese ever called me nigger. People of color were going and seeing that the conditions for the poor and people of color in Vietnam were not different, and the way they were treated was not different than they were being treated at home. And that the connection was that they were fighting a war that didn't represent their ultimate interests within the society at home. And the promises of World War II were already being eroded from the troops that came back then and were trying to use their military duty as the grounds for citizenship or assimilation into the society were already being corrupted. And they weren't given the kind of power that they needed. And so all of these three things, the racism, the poverty, and the militarism, were being addressed by these movements. And they literally saw it as a potential for revolutionary change. And they were frantic on how to stop it. And I don't think they knew how effectively to stop Dr. King. I think the killing him, in a sense, is their admission that they could not disrupt his movement or dismantle it, that he had a moral and political authority that they couldn't overcome. Of course, by killing him, they didn't kill the legacy that he left. And in the end, they can't kill the truth because there are always more of us than we can think. But they targeted Dr. King, and among the documents that I sent to Doug Valentine that we had gotten loose, in part from the John F. Kennedy assassination records collection, we passed an act in 1992 following the Oliver Stone film JFK, which ended with the thing saying that the documents were still locked up, which meant that thousands of letters and calls went to Congress saying, why don't you release these documents on JFK? Since there had always been a vast majority of people in the country didn't believe the Warren Commission, believed that there was a conspiracy in the John F. Kennedy case, and so they wanted the records released. And that led to us being able to push through a law that for the first time had an impact. The Freedom of Information Act, which was really created to look at corporate files, wasn't working on national security files because the agency itself had to decide to release its own secrets. The agency itself would decide whether there was national security involved. The Freedom of Information Act has many clauses under which you can deny release of a file, and it could be withheld forever. The John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Act, on the other hand, has a presumption of release, an independent review board that makes the decision to release the record. The agencies can appeal to the president, but it's the same president that has appointed the board. And it also has very few conditions under which you can postpone release of a record or part of a record, that you're identifying an existing agent that's still operating or a source or method that's currently being used. It can't be just that something's embarrassing from the past. Under the Freedom of Information Act, requests and lawsuits from 1964 till 1994, we got loose about 2,000 pages on the John F. Kennedy assassination that had been classified. From 1994, when the board was finally formed for the JFK Act, until the present, and the process isn't ended yet, we have 6.5 million pages released, one of the largest releases of classified documents in U.S. history. We were just recently outstripped by a similarly structured independent board for the Nazi War Crimes Records Act, which has released 8.5 million pages to date. And the bill that I helped work on for Cynthia McKinney, two bills actually now, were based on the JFK Records Act, And one is a Martin Luther King Records Act, which was introduced two Congresses ago when she was going out of office and didn't have any legs. And then we reintroduced it in the current Congress last March. Since then, we've gotten 62 co-sponsors for the bill. And just recently on April the 4th, without any press release, although we're hoping to do a joint press conference about it, Senator Kerry from here in Massachusetts introduced a companion bill in the Senate, which gives us the momentum that we need to actually get this passed. We know that 600,000 to 700,000 pages exist in the House Select Committee assassination study from the 1970s on the King assassination. It is locked up otherwise till 2028. We believe that there are other federal, not only federal, but state and local government records regarding King. And this is not solely a bill about King's assassination. It's a bill to release the records on his life, activities, and death. But you're also facing a machinery of classification that is going at a much faster rate than anything we can throw at it. And while these are the largest releases, they are merely a dent. As an example, in 2004, 16.4 million records. When I say records, I don't mean pages, because any record could be multiple pages, but 16.4 million records were classified in one calendar year. Since Bush came into office, he also reversed an executive order from President Clinton that would have released every classified document that was 25 years or older in the late 90s. So that would have gone to 47, say, to about 97, you know, and then back 25 years. But anything 25 years or older would be released. That was delayed up until the time of Bush's election. Now he has delayed it even further. It's never been implemented, but John Dean in a talk recently about the impeachment noted that had that been implemented, a billion records would have been released. Not a billion pages, again, a billion records. To get an idea of the scope of how much they are burying of your information and your history, I live in Anacostia, which is southeast D.C., and not too far up the road from me is the Maryland line, and right over that line is Suitland, Maryland. In Suitland, Maryland is the National Military Archive. These are the military files since the end of World War II that have been classified. They are kept in underground buildings. Each building is an acre in size. There are 27 buildings. 27 acres of buried documents solely on the military classified history of this country since the end of World War II. In addition to that, we don't know our own history from that, and some of the people that were brought in to write the history of World War II, the official history, at the Army Historical Division were 26 official historians for the Reich who made connections through Douglas MacArthur and his intelligence staff, which was run by a fascist, and he brought number of these historians here in the United States, covered their Nazi past by giving them jobs in the Historical Records Division of the Army, and they wrote the official history of World War II. One of them was sent on a temporary duty order to write the Warren Commission report. And I found that when I went into the files. And the investigative staffs of the Warren Commission argued with almost every page of that report. Where did he get this conclusion? What is this based on? And they at least released with the Warren Commission because there was a discussion with Hale Boggs and Dulles near the end. And Boggs said, now, if we just release this report and these conclusions and we don't have any evidence, it's going to look a little fishy, ain't it? And Dulles said, go ahead and release them. Nobody will read it anyway. But 8,000 pages of their evidence and interviews was released, which puts the Warren Commission ahead of the 911 Commission report, which has over 100 pages of small print footnote at the back. And except for the few cases where it refers to an article in a magazine or a published book, every interview, every piece of evidence, every document, even if it wasn't classified before, is now locked up until January 2nd, 2009. A strange date, 4.5 years from when they ended, since they can lock it up for 30 years. We pushed them to release it, and this was their compromise. But it's not much of a compromise if you think what's happening on January 2nd, 2009. You're in the waning days of the current administration. There's no political cost to them to reverse this order, and by that time we will have forgotten that the 911 Commission gave Bush the power to do so. So that evidence at least could then be compared to the report. In addition to that, at least 5,000 records have been reclassified by the Bush administration, which has teams going through the National Archives looking at records that have been released and putting them back under this secret rule. by the time you could catch up, even if you said release everything tomorrow and they reviewed it, you'd already be ahead of yourself in the years that it would take to do that with the new classifications. It got to be kind of amusing because over the 30 years that we were getting documents loose from the FOIA, at one point, one document was released with the redactions, the blackouts, and then the same document would be released later with redactions, but if you put the two of them side by side, you could read the entire document because the political reasons for what they were covering up 30 years before were not the same as in the modern day. So it's an arbitrary level of secrecy, but it's a secrecy that puts us in the position of not being able to know what's happening in our country. Martin Schott says in his book, History Will Not Absolve Us, that the political paralysis in America derives from the fact that we're allowed to believe anything but to know nothing. And when you cannot know, you cannot responsibly act. A people whose history is buried from them is a conquered people. That's what conquerors do. And so by allowing history to become a commodity of the national security state, by letting them replace transparency, which makes democracy and accountability possible, with secrecy instead, we come to a situation on 9/11 where the American people don't know what has been done around the globe in the last 50 years in their name, and therefore don't know why anybody would be angry at them. But the coups and the assassinations and the grabs of resources are known to the people in the other countries who see the American hand come and go and understand the role that's carried out on behalf of the American people while we're kept in the dark for the most part, unless we want to know. It's not that it's impossible to know, but it takes a lot of work.
You are listening to John Judge on the U.S. government's role in the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and other subjects related to information warfare on Active Ingredients.
I believe that James Earl Ray, though he was forced into a guilty plea, did not kill Dr. King. I believe that based on exhaustive research that I did, including going down to Memphis. I've seen the crime scene, which has now been destroyed. The National Civil Rights Museum has reverse graded the area next to Jim's Grill where the actual assassin stood. So to stand where the real killer stood across from the balcony in the bushes, you'd have to get a cherry picker and be up in the air. There's no way that anyone could have killed Dr. King from the rooming house window. I went and stood in that tub in 1972. I opened the window, and either in order to aim a rifle far enough to the right to get where King was, you would have had to poke a hole in the wall with your left elbow, or you would have had to lean out the window and try to shoot him, which gives you no stability for the shot. In addition to that, the closest eyewitness, besides those below that are watching, the one up on the balcony level, is a photographer and filmmaker, documentarian named Joseph Lowy, who was traveling with King on the strike and taking pictures from South Africa. Turned out that he was under the employ of the CIA. But he was standing out in the balcony when King was killed, and he said that King was lifted off his feet and spun to his right. If the shot is coming from up there, I'm going to be spun to my left and knocked down off of my feet. So the reaction is exactly the opposite. It's coming from across the street, and when you see these people standing and pointing in the photograph with some of King's aides, if you look at the actual angle of the motel, they are not pointing to the rooming house. The police didn't go into the rooming house for over an hour. Some of the people saw someone get up in the bushes, dismantle a rifle, run down the side of the hill, get on a motorcycle, and leave from the area. Jim Earl Ray was not in the rooming house at the time. He was changing a tire. He came back around, saw a bunch of police, and kept going. But Ray was allowed to escape from prison, arranged escapes. He was set up as a patsy and pushed into the position. He had this character, Raul, is all that he knew him by, that he met in Canada. He was trying to get a passport out of the country, so Raul was using him as a mule to carry things across different borders. He took him to Memphis, and he ordered him to buy the gun. I talked to the guy at the rifle store that sold James Earl Ray the gun, and he said the only person that ever came in that knew less about guns than James Earl Ray was the House Select Committee investigator that came in the 70s to ask about it. Ray was no marksman, he was no expert, but in addition to that, there was a trial before the civil trial because Dr. Pepper was also the attorney for James Earl Ray in his last attempt at a legal appeal of his case. And he was never allowed to really try his stuff in court, but Pepper came up with a clever interpretation of the laws that said if mostly based on DNA, but if new scientific methods made it possible to revisit a case and look at the evidence under new scientific capabilities, that you could then open an appeal on the case and at least hear that aspect. So he did that with the rifle. And Judge Joe Brown, who was an independently elected judge in Memphis, a former Black Panther, an African American, Yale educated, and a ballistic expert, sat on the trial as the judge. He allowed the scientific evidence. He had the weapon tested, and in the first test, it showed differences in the effect of the rifling on the bullet from the bullet that they had evidence had gone into Dr. King. So Dr. King's bullet didn't match. So the press, of course, said, it's inconclusive. Well, if you're on a murder trial and it's inconclusive whether the bullet came from your gun, you are acquitted, you're exonerated. I mean, that's what ballistics and forensics are for. But the press tried to make it seem like it's all confused, you can't determine. There was one more test that Judge Brown wanted to do, but before he could do it, the state Supreme Court of Tennessee stepped in and removed him from the case for being biased in Ray's favor. Then Ray wanted to continue. They were going to appoint another judge, but Ray was sick from a liver disease he got from being stabbed once in the prison and needed a new liver. Pepper found a place to replace the liver in a civilian hospital. The state authorities would not allow Ray to leave the prison, and effectively a death sentence. And so he died without the case being taken to court. Then the only other option was the civil trial by the King family to try to get the actual facts out. And Pepper's two books, Orders to Kill and Act of State, outline his investigation of that. But it goes beyond these small actors to a much larger network. And Pepper also develops evidence that there was a backup sniper team on top of one of the water towers at the railroad building down the street in Memphis with King directly in their sights. The documents that I got loose, I filed, based in part on Operation Phoenix and some reports in the Memphis papers about the military surveillance of Dr. King, I filed a Freedom of Information Act request, and then it became a trial, a court suit, because they wouldn't honor it. First, they told us they had nothing. For the last 2 months of King's life, what did Army intelligence have on Dr. King? They came back and said they had nothing on Dr. King. We said, this is Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. You know, you never heard of this fellow? And they said, no, we don't have a thing. All of the, if we had anything, it would have been destroyed. So we went to court. We tried to show how they didn't look at their filing system properly. And the judge ruled in their favor. But then after all that, they said, oh, we do have one document that we sent over to the National Archives as part of a larger collection on the Civil Rights era. And it's 30 pages. And come down to the archive tomorrow and you can get it. This is a 30-page after-action report. An after-action report is a summary. It's not the raw data. And it talks about Operation Lantern Spike, which was supposedly an anti-riot unit under Garden Plot, which was a broader military counterinsurgency plan that included detention centers and martial law. They had it out in California as well, the early inceptions of it under Reagan, Meese, and Gefreda. Gefreda became an early head of FEMA. Mr. Louis Gefreda, he had worked at the Army War College, and he had developed a plan for the for taking all blacks in the United States and putting them in detention centers in a time of emergency. And actually studied, this was his thesis, was how he could round up all the blacks in the United States. So he came into FEMA. FEMA and the DOD were working on readiness exercise plans through the 80s on what to do in national emergencies, how to detain people, and he presided over some of that. In fact, one of his deputies is currently in the post-9/11 planning for martial law and other sorts of things. So this mentality continues unbroken to this day, but post-9/11, now military spying has started up again. Ashcroft told the FBI, basically, don't worry about those provisions. Go back to looking at groups that haven't done anything illegal. Spy on the churches, spy on the political activities. Data mining and databases is more advanced. The NSA, prior to 9/11, start spying on larger numbers of people. Basically, the gate is open. But Lantern Spike was spying very closely on Dr. King, looking at what was in his garbage, planting bugs in the room, knew what his plans were for travel. This was tight surveillance. At the same time, under the JFK Act, we got loose documents that showed that the FBI under RIBAT, which was an anti-communist program, were spying on him, but also COINTELPRO was active on it. And then we got a third document that shows that the CIA, Operation Chaos, which was a similar anti-movement, anti-cultural program under the CIA, which had its own documents about dangerous black leadership in the country, was spying on him very tightly, right up to the day of his death. In other words, all three of those are spying on him actively. And we said, if you saved an after action report because it had historical significance, you didn't destroy it, then don't the raw data that led to the summary have more historical significance? Where are they? And they say, oh, well, that was destroyed. Nobody has anything. So we want to get a situation where the agencies aren't making those decisions any longer, where we have a way to go in and force them to turn over the bulk of their documents and then to start to make a decision in a more open way. We've put in provisions that we would have a Citizens Advisory Council and committee for the board that will be appointed for this act that will include the King family. We've made provisions for a second depository, perhaps the King Center or the King Center Project. We've gotten support from former members of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Bob Edgar and Walter Fauntroy. We've gotten public support from civil rights leaders. We're about to get the King Center, I think, and the SCLC to come on board. And we have other government openness and civil rights organizations that are going to support the bill. But it does need additional congressional co-sponsors and public pressure to get it moving. I based a second bill on the Martin Luther King Act, which is for all the files on the life and death of Tupac Shakur, because he similarly was a target of this surveillance throughout his life. His family includes his mother and father, Effendi Shakur, and his father, who were part of the Panther 21 trial. Black Panthers were set up on a phony charge after being penetrated by an agent of Boss, the security system in New York, which is the same agency that penetrated the security of Malcolm X when he was assassinated at the ballroom, the Audubon in New York. And Boss set up a situation where they would try to get these guys involved in a plot to blow, I think it was to blow up the Statue of Liberty. And then they brought these phony charges against them based on their own provocateur activity. His aunt, Asada Shakur, was broken out of prison by the Weather Underground and lives in Cuba now. His stepfather and sort of mentor, Mutulu Shakur, was framed on the Brinks robbery and is still in prison to this day. So if you don't think they were looking at that family, you don't understand how COINTELPRO works. And they were also looking at Tupac as he rose to national prominence. So he began to bring politics that he had learned from his family into his music and learned from his life experiences and was a powerful voice. One of the things I organized for Cynthia McKinney in September were panels at the Congressional Black Caucus called Countering Culture, which was about the attacks on political musicians all through the period, from the 40s forward, the attacks on Paul Robeson. And we had his son speak, who believes that he was given drugs that caused him to commit suicide by the government. Harry Belafonte, alive today, and just stood up with Cynthia McKinney recently, who was pilloried and called a communist and kept, but many others. There's a good documentary film, if you can get on DVD, called Scandalize My Name, narrated by Morgan Freeman, that talks about this whole history of the actors, the political. So it's not only the predominant culture countering any alternative culture, it's also a destruction of the cultural modes. And this is a history that you can track back probably through all of human history, but very specifically, I found evidence in my work on the rise of fascism in Nazi Germany, that in the period from 1928 to 1932, there were 400 unsolved political murders. The Weimar Republic said they knew they were political. They said they couldn't understand who had done them, and they involved musicians, artists, labor leaders, activists, progressives. When people say to me, "Aren't you glad that Saddam Hussein is no longer in power?" My response is yes, and I'd be even gladder if the CIA hadn't put him in power by giving him the names of 400 activists, democratic forces, and others to kill in his country to put the Ba'ath Party in power in the first place, and then armed him, including with weapons of mass destruction, to go after Iran. You know, I can't be too happy about putting in 80 dictators and taking out two. You know, there's something else going on. So, but this is a pattern that I think has existed in this country and up to the current day, and we did the hip-hop generation as well, and the murders of Biggie Small and Tupac Shakur, and questions around the role of the Ramparts Division, the LAPD, and the fact that we've got government documents showing again that until the day of Tupac's death and in the hour of his death, he was under government surveillance, the documents of which have never come forward. And he has, I would say, arguably to a current generation, as much impact as Dr. King had. He may not have the same historical legacy eventually, but as much impact in terms of the minds of the youth, and especially in the communities of color. So I think it's important that we at least try to establish a principle to get back to our own history. So we have a second gunman. We have Ray not shooting the gun, the rifle that's said to be the murder weapon, not the murder weapon. This is also constant pattern through the political assassinations I studied. Patsies are set up, but when Ray gets to prison, the money deal for his lawyer, Percy Foreman, is based on a book deal with William Bradford Huey, who had just gotten finished writing something about the murder of Emmett Till. After Emmett Till's killers were exonerated by the courts, he paid them several thousand dollars to tell how they killed him in Life magazine, and then he becomes the chronicler of James O. Ray, who allegedly kills Dr. King. And Bradford Huey's book, his condition was that the book had to be an exclusive story. Therefore, Ray had to keep his mouth shut at the trial. Then Foreman shows up in order for the book to sell, and then the proceeds from the book to pay Foreman's salary. Foreman shows up at the last minute and tells Ray, "I'm tired. I didn't have any time to prepare a defense. You better plead guilty." And Ray understood that he'd been sold out. Many people say he confessed to the killing. He did not. He did plead guilty because he thought that Foreman told him, otherwise you're going to go to the chair. And then in addition to that, Foreman illegally gave $500 to Jerry Ray, the brother, to pay for the lawyer for the appeal. And Ray immediately, within 3 days after his conviction, filed for an appeal of his case with Judge Battle, who was, under Memphis law and Tennessee law, the only judge that could hear the case and take an immediate appeal. And Judge Battle was reading Ray's appeal on his desk when he fell dead of a heart attack and stopped the first appeal. A later judge, Miller, a progressive judge, stair-step integration decision in Cincinnati on the Sixth Circuit that heard some later appeals by Ray and backed Ray up and asked the right questions. In a second appeal back to, that was remanded to the local court and then brought back up for a final appeal to the Sixth Circuit, and Judge Miller was sitting, and I was anxious to see how it would be decided, and it came out that it was 3-0 on the legal panel against Ray, and I found that surprising because Miller had also been the judge that charged Hoffa with jury tampering, Jimmy Hoffa, and was an independent judge. And so I called the clerk of courts and asked him to send me the clerk slip, and then when I got the clerk slip, there was also an article in the Cincinnati Inquirer that said that Judge Miller had gone out to lunch with the other justices, come back into an emergency session, and died of a heart attack in the session. And then it said it had the list of the judges who had decided against Ray with an asterisk next to Judge Miller's name, and then the asterisk underneath said that his decision had been recorded posthumously by the other justices. Sit the dead man up and raise his hand. There were other strange deaths around Dr. King. A.D. King, the brother, was found drowned in a swimming pool, fully dressed in a suit at the back of the family home. He was one of the few witnesses also at the morgue. The mother of Dr. King was shot to death in the church in Atlanta, and I did a good deal of work on the person that did the shooting, Marcus Wayne Chennault. He told the SCLC from prison that he was part of a group called the Troop, or the Truth, that were out to kill black leaders across the United States and that they had been given lists. He had a mentor named David Hill, who had taught him the gun running stuff, and David Hill had also a connection to Field Marshal Sin Kay of the SLA, who was himself a police agent. David Hill also went to Guyana and formed a group of black people in the jungles of Guyana about 10 miles from the Jonestown site, and they were allowed in to take the guns and the shoes and the valuables from the dead in Jonestown afterwards. And they were run by the government there, which had been put into power by the CIA. So, and this guy has all the earmarks, Marcus Wayne Chennault, of a programmed assassin, because one of the capabilities that they studied from World War II forward was how you could not only erase memory on people and control their minds, but how you could program people to carry out assassinations under mental control and under orders. And they found examples of these programmed assassins. One tried to kill Marcos in the Philippines, and Chenault comes out grinning, a gun in each hand, and says, he's smiling, and he says, "I did what I had to do." So, I don't know who this guy is, but the effect is the mother is killed brutally in the church. And there were other deaths that I tracked, deaths of witnesses. One of the key witnesses against the official case is Grace Walden Stevens, who was in the rooming house and saw the man run from the bathroom. Grace Walden Stevens was not allowed to testify at Ray's trial. She was instead put into a mental institution by the FBI because she wouldn't identify Ray from the photos as the person she saw running out of the building. And meanwhile, Charles Quitman Stevens, who was dead drunk at the time and not even conscious, is used as their lead witness. They pay off $2,000 in his bar bills, and then he becomes a lead witness against Ray and claims that he saw Ray run out of the rooming house. Another problem is that Ray runs out with a bundle that includes this rifle that eventually can be traced back to him and that they say is the murder weapon. Not only the FBI not traced the rifle, but Kniep, Jim Kniep from the amusement store where the bundle was dropped, said it was dropped 5 minutes before he heard the shot. So there are, discrepancies there, but Grace Walden Stevens is finally taken out of the mental institution under an arrangement to get her to Jonestown. And I don't know if she's among the Jonestown dead. But there was an attempt by two of the people around Jones to get her a fake passport, and they asked whether they still had the passport of a woman who was murdered, strangely, Maxine Sweeney, up in Ukiah before Jones went to Guyana. So I found connections to the Guyana operation. I found links to other intelligence operations around connected deaths that kept the story from eventually coming out. When an FBI agent who had been part of, a black FBI agent, had been part of searching Ray's car, found pieces of paper that he pocketed at the time because he didn't think that they would survive, which showed handwriting of Ray's with the name Raul, which backed up his story, and a phone number on one of them that was Jack Ruby's phone number in Dallas. Okay, and these came to light eventually, and the FBI discredited them, and they wrote a whole report trying to discredit Dr. Pepper, which he answers in Act of State. So this case, even though it was argued out, and you can see the whole transcript and get the evidence at the King Center site, hardly anyone covered that trial. I think they covered Mrs. King's testimony, but when you got to the testimony of the heart of the case and James Earl Ray, that wasn't there. There were no reporters in the main. In fact, one reporter who insisted on staying was fired by one of the major networks because he was taking down the information. I'll close with quotes that I like from Dr. King. This is from a little book, Martin Luther King Jr. Companion. "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. The chain reaction of evil, hate beginning hate, wars producing more wars, must be broken, or we shall be plunged into the abyss of annihilation." He also once said that the choice today, and this is even in his time, is not between violence and nonviolence, it's between nonviolence and non-existence. "Our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. We have guided missiles and misguided men."
Expose the government cover-up of 9/11. What sort of change do you think we have, and what level of dissension is there within the military intelligence community right now and the police community in terms of the degree to which they'll cooperate in carrying out martial law using the detention centers that have been established?
Well, I think there'll always be some resistance when they try to get citizens to work against other citizens. They use our fear, they use propaganda, they use lies, they make us enemies. They destroy our sense of community and our sense of trust among each other, and they mean to do it. You know, they put people in compromised positions. The troops that are brought into the riot at Watts are not from L.A. They're flown in from someplace else, and they land with a bunch of rocks and bottles, and they start shooting. They know that because they're young kids with rifles. On the other hand, there's revolt in the military. Quite often, right now, the war in Iraq, there's 5,500 absent. There were 2,000 a day going AWOL before the war started. They aren't going to be able to hold these troops forever. Their families are disgusted. They're on constant rotation. They're on stop loss. They've finished their 8 years, and they still can't get out of the military. They keep throwing them back in this untenable situation, and eventually it's going to crack, and they know it. Of course, it only leaves them aerial bombardment and nuclear weapons for Iran, but they can't take a ground war into Iran. I've been doing a lot of work on 9/11 from that day forward. I know that it was not an intelligence failure because they had multiple warnings and they knew the specifics of the attack and they, in fact, prepared for those specifics. At least at the Pentagon, they did. I was there in 99. The head of security, I was outside the building. He told me they were on Delta alert. I said, "What's that?" He said, "It's our highest form of security alert, Alpha, Beta, Charlie, Delta." I said, "Why are you on Delta?" This is 99. We're standing outside the building. He points to the roof of the building, and he says, "And we've got camera and radar up there so they don't try to run a plane into the building." Now, 99, I thought the guy was looped. But they knew. They knew from 95, 96. They got Ramzi Youssef's computer, the Bajinka plan, in that case, to hijack planes abroad and bring them in the United States and then target what? The CIA, the Pentagon, the White House, the Capitol, and the Twin Towers. I mean, the Twin Towers is hardly a sneak attack. They hit it with a bomb in 93. So it's not an intelligence failure. It's not that they didn't know. They had warnings from all different countries, even the Taliban. And they had quite a bit of specific warning. You know, and Bush had this super secret presidential briefing on August the 6th that said that attack was imminent from Osama bin Laden inside the United States. Well, if he'd maybe let more than six people see that, somebody might have known what was coming. What you do have on 9/11 is this breakdown in standard operating procedure by FAA in an air emergency, by NORAD and the National Military Command Center that's supposed to scramble planes and doesn't. Also by P-56, the most restricted airspace in the world around D.C., does not respond. I was up and had Channel 8 on, and I knew a plane was coming to D.C. They said one of the hijacked planes was coming to D.C. 20 minutes before it hit the Pentagon. I know when it hit the Pentagon because it shook my windows. I'm right across the river. So they knew. They knew it was coming. They weren't in the dark. Their radars don't work 180 degrees and don't go the rest of the 360 degrees. They tried to claim to the commission, the 9/11 commission. There wasn't a fog of war. There was a failure to do what you're supposed to do in the first 10 minutes of an air emergency. And planes never went up. Even when planes got up, they were called back from responding. The Otis planes, the pilots told people at the base when they landed that they were in New York, both towers burning. They knew about the plane coming to D.C., and they turned to intercept it, and they were called back. The Langley planes in Virginia were sent so late and out to their staging point and told to go to New York, and were only asked on the way past the Pentagon to see if it had been struck, and they confirmed a plume of smoke. That's the defense the Pentagon got. But there are separate defenses with MP-56. There are jet fighters at Andrews Air Force Base and 113th Air Wing in Anacostia. They don't go up. The Pentagon has its own defenses. When he said the camera and radar, so a plane does, it's not the camera and radar that's going to stop the plane. They must have something else that it's connected to. And when I was 10 or 11 years old, I remember going out in the courtyard on a sunny day to have lunch with my parents. We'd buy some food in a canteen on a good day and go out and eat and in the open space in the middle of the Pentagon. And I sat on a silver box. My dad said, "Get the hell off of that." And I said, "What is it?" He said, "It's a surface-to-air missile port." That's the 1960s. Do you think they took them all down? Or they improved them? They let it come. Whether they planned it or not is another level, but it does have a historical context of covert operations, of funding the Mujahideen, including Osama bin Laden, when he was going against the Soviet Union, of bin Laden Construction Company under CIA money building the caves in Afghanistan that he's supposedly later hiding out in, of bin Laden working for many different aspects of intelligence-run things, as well as what they call al-Qaeda, which is a term that bin Laden began to use only after Bush used it, and which is meaningless. It's like saying somebody's part of the movement in the 1970s. There is no concentrated network of terrorist cells all over the world that calls itself al-Qaeda. There's no such thing. There are factional fights even within any country among the terrorist cells. And many of them are manipulated up to the current day and interact with intelligence. They get their training, they get their weapons from intelligence agencies. And our intelligence agencies was part of creating it And are they still in control of it? One of the hearings I went to with Cynthia McKinney was on Able Danger. This is a top secret black op unit inside the Pentagon. We don't know a lot about it, but we know that it had a data mining capability, but that the data miners were only less than a dozen people, according to the report. Then we've heard anywhere from 20 to 80 people in the whole unit, and the rest were for operations. It was planning covert operations. Every time Kurt Weldon in Congress, who keeps bringing this up, we asked for an investigation, a hearing at the House Select Committee, so did he got other people signed, not House Select Committee, the House Armed Services Committee, and he got people sign on in Congress for at least a hearing, and we get the hearing, and we brought up the whistleblower. But every time Kurt Weldon mentions Able Danger, he defines it, its purpose as to manipulate, degrade, or destroy al-Qaeda. When Schaefer testified, he testified in open session, then he went to a closed briefing. I asked him in between, have you heard this phrase, manipulate, degrade, or destroy al-Qaeda? And he starts grinning. And I said, what is the source of this phrase defining the purpose of Able Danger? He said, that's in the implementing order from General Shelton when it was formed. That's right after 9/11. And I said, now, when you say manipulate, degrade, or destroy, you're talking about three separate functions or any combination of those functions. It's not and destroy, it's or destroy. It has a different meaning in the English language. He starts grinning again and nods his head, and he said, yes, and we were planning out off-the-shelf operations, ready to go, completely planned for all three of those options. I said, then could you tell me what is meant by the phrase manipulate al-Qaeda? And he grinned again, even broader, and said, that's why we're going into closed session. These things are not outside. In a covert world, even your enemies can be part of operations. You penetrate them, you use them, you have negative assets. You manipulate and control them at different points. Now, we don't have the final goods on this. We don't have a lot of the documents we need on this. A big push for any 9/11 truth movement right now, to me, would be to get the documents loose that the 9/11 Commission had, because otherwise we're just speculating. And this report has too much credibility, although it shouldn't, if you knew its real history and who put it together and the mistakes in it and the omissions, but it has credibility among the public. It's not going to be destroyed by throwing theories at it. We have to deconstruct it with documents and hard facts. But it should be that we have transparency. It took us long enough to even get an investigation. It was a very poor investigation. It focused on policies, and most of those recommendations are flawed as well, including trying to depoliticize intelligence by centralizing it all under one director, which does exactly the opposite, especially when the director is Mr. Negroponte, who has ties with the death squads, you know, in Central America, and who was part of the Contragate operations. The two major covert operations in the current period, and these are huge, they were the most expensive that were ever carried out. One was the funding and support of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to break the back of the Soviet Union, or try to. It wasn't the only, the Soviet Union was collapsing anyway, and these people that say that Afghanistan alone is what destroyed them are the neocons bragging and tooting their horn. But they were trying to undermine them, at least, and drag them into a quagmire. And that started in the Carter years. Brzezinski, he goes over and talks to these people, and he thinks it's a clever idea to arm them. And he's still unapologetic. He says to this day, what are a few stirred-up Muslims compared to the fall of the Soviet Union? And so he goes over and starts arming him, but he goes out of office, Reagan comes in, and William Casey starts to head the CIA. So Casey carries on covert, off-the-shelf operations, funding not admitted, to carry out this thing, and it costs $6 billion. What are the routes for that money? Half of it is put up by the Saudis, Saudi royals, Saudi intelligence, Saudi oil money, and passed through to Osama, who's part of a Saudi ruling family himself. And they think it's a good idea, stabilize the region, et cetera. And the other half comes through American CIA and opium profits out of Afghanistan, because the way the CIA funds many of its covert operations is with drug money. That's why we can't see the CIA budget, because it wouldn't cover their operations. They'd have to explain where they get their dough. But there's been a long-term connection between intelligence operations and drug operations. Okay, so that money, but it's funneled in order to cover that it's the CIA. It's funneled through, although it can't be all that dense, because many of these people are brought to the United States to be trained and then sent back to Afghanistan and at military bases. But there's definitely a CIA connection, but they're trying to hide a little bit, so they funnel the funds through the Pakistani military intelligence, ISI. And that's the main funnel of the money for that covert operation.
This has been a presentation of Abby Adams and the Information Collective on the role of the U.S. government in the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Active Ingredients. This was a presentation of the Information Collective, infocollective.org.